Your job when you're part of a team isn't to love everything. You might need to speak up when you don't want to speak up, but your ideas might be critical and bring up a problem or a solution that we need to discuss. When there's a sense of a common mission, common goal, that you're heading in the same direction, it very much enforces a culture that you're in it together. And human beings survived as a species and were rewarded as a species for collaboration.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. So friends, are you ready to join me? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, I am just smiling thinking about today's episode, and I think you guys are going to love it. It is with my dear friend, John Levy, who never fails to completely fascinate me. Not only is he a behavioral scientist, he is also a multi-bestselling author and the founder of the Influencers Dinner. I've known him for years, and he never fails to make me smile or blow my mind. I had the best time reading his book, Team Intelligence, How Brilliant Leaders Unlock Collective Genius, and asking John all of my questions today. Get excited because we touch on so many topics. You're going to learn what actually makes a brilliant leader, and yes, it's probably not what you think. The role of women when it comes to success, problems with too much talent on a team, the myth of the alpha male, how many social connections you can actually have and how to maintain them, how to deal with narcissists, how to find your super skills, and so much more. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/teamintelligence. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about, so definitely check that out. I can't wait to hear what you guys think. Definitely let me know in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. Hi friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon, and new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. All right, I think that's all the things. Without further ado, please enjoy this incredible conversation with my dear friend, John Levy. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am just giddy with excitement about the conversation I'm about to have. It is with one of my dear, dear friends who... This is a guest that when I first had him on the show, his book at the time that I had him on for, You're Invited, completely blew my mind. And it was one of those things where going into it, I was so excited to interview him and I didn't know that we would become such lovely friends. And I just absolutely adore what he's doing. And so when John Levy, who I'm here with today, said that he had a new book out called Team Intelligence, How Brilliant Leaders Unlock Collective Genius, I just knew that I immediately had to have him on the show or as soon as possible once I read the book. And friends, this book is absolutely mind-blowing. So basically what it talks about, which we will talk all about on today's show, is what actually leads to great leaders, great companies, great teams, because you would think there would be some sort of formula for success there, but is there? I don't know. We're going to talk about that. And we'll talk about, obviously, the role of intelligence and all of that, and how if intelligence is such a key to this, then why does a big group of people who are intelligent not necessarily be the answer? So we'll talk about that. And then there's all this just crazy, mind-blowing stuff about what led to the concept of a singular leader, the problems with this alpha male concept, the shocking history of the MBA, stuff on personality tests and company culture. And it is just so fascinating. This is one of those books, because I read a lot of books for this show, this is one of those books that I was just so happy to read because every sentence is just fascinating. So, John, thank you so much for being here. Oh, and congrats, because it was 4 weeks on the bestseller list. Yes?
Yes, it was. So first of all, thanks for having me on. I was beyond excited that I got to be back here. I think you know I love our conversations and look for any excuse to hang out with you. So this is a treat. Yeah, Team Intelligence. I'm super proud of this book. It spent 4 weeks on the national bestseller list. It also got a star review from both Kirkus and Publishers Weekly. It's not one of those things where like, five stars exist. It's like you either get a star or you don't. So it's my first book that like got attention as I guess by the people who are super smart and do book reviews.
Well, that is really important. I wonder if they evaluated their own situation, like at their jobs after reading the book.
Oh, that's so funny. So I'm not at liberty to discuss.
Oh, okay. No comment. No comment. One of my memories about this actually is when I first saw the cover and I was like, oh, it's fireflies. And you're like, it's not fireflies. Are you sure it's not fireflies on the cover?
No, it's definitely fireflies.
It's a metaphor.
Yes.
Okay. It is a firefly metaphor.
Yeah. The idea was that they figured out how to get out of the jar. So for those of you who don't see the book, it looks like there's a jar and these glowing firefly kind of happy beings that look like they've just escaped from it. And they're as a group escaping. And the title of the book is Team Intelligence, How Brilliant Leaders Unlock Collective Genius.
And it is brilliant. And I have so many questions. First of all, a guessing game. Do you want to guess what my favorite fun fact was from the entire book?
Was it that Darth Vader was a terrible boss?
I did like that section because it took me a second to catch on what you were doing. John like describes this whole like leadership situation and it's Star Wars in the end. Like you don't say it's Star Wars at the beginning when you're describing it.
Oh, definitely not. I'm discussing some of the worst bosses in history. And I talk about one that terrified his employees so much that when they were building a base, they clearly were too scared to tell him there was a design flaw. And then Rebel Forces blew it up. And it was the story of Star Wars.
Yeah, when I was reading it, I was like, wait, is this NASA? Like what happened? And yeah, that's not it, because that was not a disappointment, but where's the Star Trek analogy?
We had a Star Trek analogy?
I don't know. There's not. That's why I'm saying the Star Wars can't be the answer, because I can give you a hint. It has to do with me. No, it has to do with them. I'll give it away. Half of the population.
Oh, yes. For your listeners, I spent basically years trying to understand what makes great leaders and great teams. And so it turns out that those things are kind of separate from each other. After September 11th, a group of people did a review of what happened, and they discovered that the CIA actually knew half of the entire plan. And the FBI basically knew the other half. The two were so bad at working together that they had the largest failure in American intelligence history. And the Twin Towers came down and all the people died. And so in the review of it, it became clear that we need to research what actually makes teams smart. Like what allows them to solve problems quickly? Because we couldn't afford another failure like that. And so there's this amazing researcher by the name of Anita Williams-Woolley. And she worked with a bunch of different research groups to figure this out. But it turns out that none of the things that we traditionally thought actually predict if a team will do well. It doesn't matter the IQ of the smartest person on the team. It doesn't matter the average IQ of the team members. It doesn't really matter how much they like each other. The biggest predictor was actually adding Melanie to the team did more than adding me. It is the number of women on the team. The more women, the better the team did.
Isn't this mind-blowing? Except it's at least two women, right? There has to be at least two.
So very insightful. Here's what I want to do, which is it's really common for us to take what's easy to see and just assume that that's what's going on rather than considering what's really useful. So why is it the number of women? And why does it, as you pointed out, start at two and continues getting higher, but it can't be the entire group? And the answer is a few things. First of all, there tends to be the need when women are in groups to have what's called the ally effect, which is that when you're the only one of a marginalized group, then it's hard to speak up. When you have two or more, then you have a cohort. So it really, there is a byproduct of kind of guys just being terrible at including women, frankly. And when there's one guy on the team, then it ends up being enough. The second factor is that it actually isn't because you're women. It's because women test higher on emotional intelligence. When you look at how groups actually work, you could be, let's say, a tennis player and have it be pure talent. Like that's your super skills, you're like awesome at it. You don't need anybody else and you don't need to rely on them. But when you go from a single person activity where, let's say, IQ or talent matter to a group activity, then now you're, let's say basketball, you're now mostly like passing the ball rather than shooting. And so the ability to coordinate becomes more important than the ability to really just shoot that shot. And as a byproduct, what happens is that the teams that have more emotional intelligence have a better chance of coordination, because then they know when they can push on a topic and when they shouldn't, how to coordinate, how to map the unwritten rules of an organization, and so on. It's the ability to call on somebody when you know they're scared to speak up, but they have something important to share. And that's why it's people can point to women, although there are plenty of men with really high emotional intelligence.
This is so, so interesting. It's interesting also, I interviewed Candy Weens. She has a book called Burnout Immunity, and she was trying to find the singular thing that led to burnout, or no, that made people immune to being burned out, and it was high emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence seems to be the bee's knees, as it were. Does the emotional intelligence of a person extend to the team automatically? Like, what's the difference between an individual intelligence, either just what we think of normally, or emotional intelligence, and then the team? Like, how do you make it stick to the team?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question that the researchers had to tackle. So what does it mean when I say, oh, Melanie, she's really smart or intelligent? It means that in most situations, if you have a problem in front of you, you'll be able to figure out a solution quickly. The faster you figure out that solution, the more we generally call you intelligent. And that's how we evaluate teams. We don't say, oh, that team has 14 Nobel laureates, thereby they're probably going to solve problems quickly. No, we ask the question, does the team actually solve those problems quickly? And if so, what led to that? And so if you're a leader or on a team, what you really care about is the speed that you get things done. And so now we can begin to ask what actually causes that. What makes that team solve problems quickly? And it turns out that it's an unexpected series of characteristics. And there's this kind of fun thing. Do you remember I talked about the too much talent problem in the book?
Yes.
Yeah. So and this is kind of like a weird thing that as a listener, you should see if you can figure this out. It turns out that in basketball and in soccer, when you cross about the 50% mark of top talent, the team scores less. You actually do worse. Now, this exists in basketball and soccer, but not in baseball. There's no upper max. I'm just going to give you a second to try and think through why that might be the case. The answer has to do with a group of chickens from the 1970s and 80s. Do you remember the story?
I do. The beaks.
Yes, the beaks. How awful is that? So, to answer this question, you have to understand that in the 70s, there was this egg called the DeKalb XL. It was a chicken, actually, that was like the Ferrari of chickens. It could outlay any chicken out there. It was like just the best egg-laying chicken. The problem was that it had been bred for so many years to lay eggs for pure productivity that it became hyper-competitive, and it would actually peck the other chickens around it to death.
It's fairly violent.
Yeah, yeah. And like, have you ever had a corporate job?
I had like an internship at film production companies. Does that count?
Actually, maybe. The film industry is a lot like that, which is that like people keep competing and competing to get to the top. And at a certain point, the only way you can ensure that you're at the top is by making sure that everybody else is in the bottom, right? So when we cause people to continuously compete at every level, then it breeds selfishness. Now, an evolutionary biologist named William Muir said, this is awful. We need to stop this. And so what he did was he took a bunch of crossbred chickens, created 200 teams of them, and then just weighed how many eggs they laid and found the teams that produced the most eggs as a group and rebred them for six generations. And what he found was that he was able to create what he called the KGB. Kindler, gentler birds. And what was amazing about them was that as a team, they laid a ton of eggs, even though no one chicken, when you pulled them out, was remarkable in any way. And when he compared these KGBs, these teams, to groups of super chickens, In a head-to-head competition after 1 year, the KGB birds demolished the super chickens, mostly because almost none of them were still alive. At the end, they'd all pecked each other to death. And herein we learn the answer, which is that when you continuously cause people to compete, it comes at the cost of the team. And when you get to the level of elite sports, when you bring more and more top talent, nobody wants to share the ball. And selfishness becomes a major issue. But in baseball, there's no way to be selfish. And so the researchers discovered that there is no upper max to talent when you have no interdependence, meaning that when my work doesn't depend on your work, when we can work completely independently of each other, then there's no upper max for talent. But the moment you actually have to function as a team, there is a too much talent problem. And we have to learn to get people to operate together. And that's more important than having pure talent.
So, and this is perfect timing because, well, not really by the time this comes out, but my episode this week, like live right now, is with a Major League Baseball player, Johnny Damon. Do you know him? I feel like you know everybody.
Oh, no, I've hosted a lot of people at my secret dining experience, but I've not many baseball.
You should have him. He's like a legend in the like New York Yankees, Red Sox world.
Oh, wow. I'm sold. If you like somebody, I'm like going to fall in love with them.
Perfect. I had a question. Okay. So applying that practically to different types of jobs, and I know you were mentioning corporate situations where people are competing to get to the top, but, and like my entrepreneur career situation, would that mean that when I'm hiring people to do a la carte related tasks for my job, like hiring a designer to design something or hiring somebody where they're just doing the job, completing it, but they don't interact with the rest of my personal team, that it's important for them to be like super high talent. But then when it comes to team members that are regularly interacting, then that's less important, the talent, or you don't want everybody to be super talented?
It's not about the talent. It's about the selfishness. Right. So in our society, that tends to go hand in hand. Because the way that you become a top basketball player is that when you're young, you have some slight advantage and then you get put on a specialty team and you kind of say goodbye to your other friends. And then you compete even against the people in your own team to get the attention of the local high schools and then the local the universities. And then no matter what, at every level, you have to be better than everybody else to make it to that next level.
Hey friends, I am about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness, It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com.
And even when you are on a basketball team in the NBA, then you still want to be the person that scores the points and gets the rebounds and all that. Because there's only one stat in basketball that predicts a player's salary, and that's the number of points they score.
Really? Wait, really? I didn't know that.
So in every player in the NBA is incentivized to be selfish.
Whoa. Wait, so if they had like a, if they were creating a basketball team and then they created a, like a quiz, I know, but we can talk about personality tests, but like a quiz that filtered out levels of selfishness and then they got the most talented from like the non-selfish pool of people, would that be the exception? Then you could have like a all talented team.
So there's actually, this is really interesting that you asked this. When researchers started looking at this question of, are there players that don't score a lot but have a huge impact on the team? They found something interesting. And it works like this. Let's say you score a ton, put up a lot of points, and you've got a really great attitude that makes the team function better. You get paid a ton of money. If you score a lot of points, but you have a terrible attitude that brings everybody down, in the NBA, you earn a ton of money. No difference. But what they found, and these were researchers from Brigham Young, is that there's an entire group of players who don't score much, but everybody else improves. Now, we know about this from like stores. If I put my top cashier in front of everybody, everybody else works faster because they set the pace. In basketball, it turns out that there are people that cause everybody else to perform better. And as a byproduct, it multiplies their results. We call them glue players. When I say multiply their results, I mean by a factor of 1.6. So if you look, these players tend to have three major characteristics. One is high emotional intelligence, because to understand how to maneuver all these big personalities, you got to know when to push and when not to, how to build their trust, how to connect the team. The second is they are proactive. They take action nobody even thought to take. So there's this player in the NBA, two-time NBA champion. His name is Shane Battier. Never really scored. He was later in his career, he was known as the no stats all-star. And he would memorize the other opposing team's stats, knowing exactly where to push somebody when you were playing so that they would miss the shot. Because maybe they have a 3% reduced chance of scoring in the left corner versus the right corner. So he would push them to the left so that they would have a worse shot. Or he would know which players he needs to block from a rebound so that his own teammates could get the rebound. So he wouldn't get any stats out of it, but his team would perform better. And then the third thing is he would put the team above himself to an extreme degree. He's one of the only players in the NBA history to say stuff like, take me out, coach, so that another player who's better suited could defend or play or shoot or whatever it was. And that's pretty amazing. And these combinations of characteristics mean that if you pair him with somebody like LeBron James, LeBron plays significantly better. The secret is actually pairing talent with glue players. And in fact, what happened was when they did this, the Miami Heat, which included LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh, these three legends of basketball, ended up winning two back-to-back championships.
Didn't you say that he also would memorize like personal facts about the players and whisper things in their ear?
So in the book, I tell a lot of jokes.
Oh, is that a joke?
Yeah.
Oh, I believe that, John. I was like, that's why I literally took a note. I was like, is that allowed?
I jokingly said he would memorize the opposing player's third grade school teacher's name.
I really believe that.
So that when he was on the court, he could tell a player that like Miss Somerset thinks you're a loser and should have never been, you know, graduated. You stink. But then I followed up with, okay, maybe that didn't happen, but you couldn't prove that. So let's just pretend that it did.
That's so funny. Does that type of player, like, did he get paid?
No, he did not. I mean, they all make great money, but he didn't make any numbers close to LeBron. Here's what's interesting about him. In the NBA, the way that you evaluate kind of a player's positive effect is a stat called the plus minus, which is with them on the court, how many additional points do you expect to score? So if with the top five players in the NBA, you get like a plus 8 to a plus 12. So that's 8 to 12 additional points on your team. Battier, who would never really score, wouldn't get many rebounds or anything like that, the team would have at his peak a plus 6, which would put him almost in the category of a superstar. But he would almost never actually score. And that's amazing that you can have such an impact when designing a team with somebody who doesn't have any meaningful statistics.
Wow. Yeah, that was one of the just comments in general that I had never thought about but appreciated from the book was you were talking about statistics in general and how they hide these things. So like when we just look at blanket statistics on anything, we don't see like these really subtle nuances.
There's a great quote by a statistician that says, statistics are like bikinis. What they hide is essential and what they show is suggestive. So like, you can make stats show a lot of stuff, but it or hint at things. But we always need to get back to not what's easy to see, but what's useful. What's easy to see is the person who scores a lot. But you could be scoring a lot and costing the team points. You could just be super selfish. Meanwhile, you could be scoring very little, but multiplying the team's results and leading to wins.
And how much of this translates, so like looking at sports teams, how much of that translates to like corporate culture?
I think that's a great question. I think the difficulty is that it's really hard to measure corporate culture because the results aren't as clear cut. Like, did your team win or lose because it's good or bad? Or did your company go under because, you know, the pandemic hit? In basketball, it's what's called a finite game. There's a clear beginning and end. And there's a clear measurement system of success. And so we can get much better stats from sports. So I'm a believer that sports is a great place to learn things from, but it doesn't deal with the realities of actual business life. So I think that when we look at the corporate world, what we'll be able to do with all these new AI technologies is actually to have an AI assistant that's constantly running, reviewing your meetings in real time. So if we were in a meeting right now, what would happen was it would say, hey, John, you've been speaking a lot. Maybe you should give somebody else the floor.
Whoa. Would that impede, though, on the team's psychological safety?
No, it'd increase it.
Really? Okay.
Because if, let's say, we talked about how high emotional intelligence kind of is this critical factor. You clearly have emotional intelligence, but let's just say, for example, you didn't, okay? And you're leading this big team and you're running a meeting and you cannot for the life of you realize that the look on people's faces is saying, this is not going well. It would be super helpful to have software running in your meeting, like a Microsoft Teams call or Zoom call or something that lets you know, hey, you're losing the crowd. Or it seems that Shauna has something to share, but she hasn't had a moment. Maybe give her the floor. And now I've taken you from an emotional intelligence level of a 3 to a 9 without any additional training.
So it would be working with the person leading the meeting, not, I mean, it's looking at everybody. The reason I was wondering if it would affect the psychological safety is maybe some people don't want to talk. And then if it's like, this person's not talking, but then they don't want to talk.
But them wanting to talk or not is not the relevant factor. What it comes down to is it is everybody's role on a team to make the team as smart as possible. Now, some people contribute that with points like LeBron did, and some people provide other things like Shane Battier did. Your job when you're part of a team isn't to love everything. You might need to speak up when you don't want to speak up, but your ideas might be critical and bring up a problem or a solution that we need to discuss.
Okay. I'm having flashbacks to high school.
We're being called on?
Yeah.
So realize, though, that there's a difference between being in high school and being in a meeting.
Slightly.
In the sense that when you're in high school, you're actively trying to learn something, or should be, right? When you're in a meeting, hopefully you're part of the team because you possess skills, knowledge, resources, mental models, experience that is a useful contribution. If I bring you in as like a health expert into a meeting, I should be able to call on you for your expertise. Now, you might say, hey, I don't have the information I need. But that's different than not being able to do a math problem at the front of the room.
And to that point with the skills, there's a whole section on skills. One of the sentences that stuck with me was something about how when it comes to leaders, like there's no minimum amount of competence required, which is a little bit discerning or disconcerting.
Yeah. So when we actually ask the question, what really defines a leader? Every organization and consultancy or MBA program says that there are these like essential skills that every leader has to have. The ability to create psychological safety, build consensus, negotiate, have a vision, like all this kind of stuff. And when you actually look at these lists, they're ridiculous. If what was required of a leader was having all of these things, we would never have a single leader. And my favorite example is Elon Musk. And the reason is, that dude does not create psychological safety or consensus. Wildly effective, but does not have many of the characteristics that we would consider, quote unquote, essential to a great leader. Neither did Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or so on and so forth. And they all built huge organizations that were wildly effective. And so what we need to accept is that there are no essential characteristics for a leader except one. And it is really stupid, Melanie. I mean, really stupid. It is that they have followers, by definition.
Mic drop. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's just idiotic. Now we have to ask, why do we follow? This took us a long time to figure out, to be honest. And it works like this. Do you remember when you were in high school on Sunday at 6 p.m., the Sunday scaries?
Yes.
Yeah, they were awful. Now, but on Friday at 1 p.m. when you were in class, how did you feel?
Very excited.
Yeah. And that doesn't make sense because you're locked in class and you're excited. You're home and you're free, but you're upset. And why is that? Because human beings actually don't relate to the present. They relate to the future that they believe they have.
That's a good one.
And so if you feel that your future is exciting, you are excited in the moment. What's interesting is that the reason we actually follow someone is that when we interact with them, we have an emotional response that causes us to feel that there will be a new and better future. You do not need to like them. You do not need to want to hang out with them. You just have to have that emotional response. The reason that people listen to your podcast is that in every episode, they gain knowledge and resources that give them a new potential future, whether that's with their health, their career, whatever it is. And that's why people follow. That's the defining characteristic of leadership. Now, I do want to say some, like a little caveat here. It doesn't mean people will be effective. You could have like kind of just a bunch of idiots following a moron, right? Like, it just answers the question, what gets the crew together for the heist? What actually lets the crew get away with the heist is this research on team intelligence.
Wow. This explains why this is just a tiny bit of a rabbit hole tangent. For me, it's very, very, I'm a big planner, and it's very important that I plan out like obviously like my work and shows and stuff, but like going to theater, I have to have things planned all the time because I need to be anticipating something always. Like, what is the next exciting thing I'm going to? And that like keeps me going. And that's why I can't understand. So people who like don't plan, I'm like, how do they anticipate? Or maybe they anticipate the freedom of not having a plan and just showing up to stuff.
So I think what you're describing is a combination of kind of two things. One is you probably have a collection of super skills that are really useful for how you maneuver through life. And what we found was that what actually gets us to follow somebody is not being well-rounded, but rather that they have these super skills that are so profoundly strong that when people interact with them, we go, wow, with that person in charge, I don't need to worry about that thing. So in the Elon Musk example that we talked about, he's not well-rounded, but he is incredible at thinking at scale, and he moves faster than anyone in our society. And as a byproduct, when you interact with those skills, you might not say, oh, I like that guy, but you will say, huh, he's going to get that done. I'll invest, or I'd join that company. That's why we actually follow. It's the person's super skills. So Melanie, I think you have a collection of really unique super skills, and so do your listeners. The key is kind of just to figure out what those are so you can lean into them. In your case, probably part of it is being really organized. The second thing that you're talking about is exactly that, that element of having a new future that gets you excited. So I often think that everybody should have their next two vacations planned. And the reason is that way, the moment the vacation that you're on is done, you still have something to look forward to.
Yeah, you don't get the sadness of the vacation ending because you have the next one coming.
Yeah, you're like, oh man, I've got to get to work. But guys, in 8 weeks, we're off to wherever. And so it doesn't feel like it's all over. It just feels like there's the next thing to look forward to. And looking forward to it is often even better than the vacation. The anticipation of going to see that theater show with your friend and getting to hang out with them, you get to have that for a long time, much longer than actually going to the theater.
Yes. We were talking before this about Disney. Words cannot describe, A, the amount of joy and excitement and anticipation I would have going to Disney World, like in high school and middle school, but the sadness, like when it was coming to an end, was I can viscerally feel that feeling in me right now. And I've had realizations and epiphanies about my life now. I'm like, I don't have that anymore. I'm so grateful. Like I never have that sadness of something ending because there's so many things coming. So yeah, keeps me going.
One of the benefits you have is by having a show that records so frequently is you always have that next conversation. And so you have something to look forward to that will help you grow and develop. Most people, I guess some people get that from listening to podcasts, but most people don't have an active social experience of development after they leave college, if they went to college.
Like constantly meeting new people and
exploring ideas.
Oh, okay. With people specifically?
Yeah. Because I want you to think about this. There's this funny thing that was kind of popular called like Baby Einstein. Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm, the meme?
Oh, no, it's just like an actual recordings of stuff that were supposed to make your child smarter, like listening to Beethoven or stuff like that.
Yeah, I remember the listening to like Mozart as a baby thing.
Yeah. And people also tried to play like recordings in other languages to help their kid learn it. But it turns out that children don't learn anything just by listening to recordings.
Oh, they have to interact.
Yeah, because we learn through social cues and interactions. And so how do you know what a chair is unless you're in 20 different scenarios where mom or dad or person said chair, right? And most learning is actually social. Like, can you learn, sit at home and learn to code? Sure, there are certain things that might lend itself to that. But when you come up against a problem, if you want to solve it quickly, what do? You call somebody, or I guess nowadays you might ask ChatGPT and it'll solve it for you. But in terms of like meaningful learning, there's a process of attempt and failure and coaching and support, and it's a fundamentally social experience. And so I think that there's a healthy component where we need to be interacting with other people in order to develop.
And I guess you get that too I'm assuming you definitely get that with your job, did I mention yet about your dinners?
I mentioned that I run dinners.
Yes. Yeah, so John has these incredible dinners, which I promise I will go to one. Someday.
Promises, promises. I've known you for 5 years now.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes. I will. The point is that he has these dinners where he invites people of certain levels of acclaim in whatever sphere they're in. So, you know, Olympians, celebrities, executives, all the different things. And but people do not introduce themselves. So I guess really, unless they're like a celebrity that you would recognize, they don't necessarily know who everybody is. And then they cook a dinner.
Even celebrities that you would recognize, out of context, people don't.
Really? Oh, that is fascinating. Really? Oh, that's interesting. Wow. So, and then these people, they cook a dinner together, right?
Yes, they produce some of the worst food you'll ever eat.
Hey, friends. Did you know there is an ancient botanical that modern research shows performs on a level comparable to metformin when it comes to supporting healthy blood sugar levels? And not only that, this compound also supports the gut microbiome, healthy cholesterol levels, and even stimulates the AMPK pathway in the body to support cellular cleanup and longevity. You might have heard about AMPK. We talk about it a lot in the context of fasting, which also stimulates it. I am talking about berberine. I take berberine every single day of my life, and I see massive differences on my CGM, my continuous glucose monitor, when I use it. I take it to support my fast and before meals to reduce blood sugar levels. It is a powerhouse of a compound. And like I said, people are prescribed the pharmaceutical metformin to control their blood sugar levels when they could be taking this completely natural compound that has been used for thousands of years in both ancient traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. I wanted to make the best berberine on the market, so that's why I created AvalonX Berberine 500. We did so much testing to find the most potent, pure, and clean form available. There's no problematic fillers, no common allergens, just pure, vegan, lab-tested berberine extracted from traditional sources. Friends, I am not kidding the difference I see on my blood sugar levels with this berberine. We're talking no post-meal spikes when I eat all that fruit and lower fasting blood sugar levels. It also reduced my HbA1c and my cholesterol levels. You can get it at avalonx.us. And the coupon code IFPODCAST will get you 10% off. You can also get a one-time 20% off coupon code when you text AvalonX to 877-861-8318. That's AvalonX to 877-861-8318. And you can get a 15% off coupon code by signing up for email updates. For that, just go to avalonx.us/email list. Again, friends, this is one of the most powerful compounds you can add into your health and wellness routine. Healthy blood sugar control, even if you're not pre-diabetic or diabetic, is so important, and berberine helps support that. It is the ultimate compound for blood sugar control, cholesterol, your gut microbiome, and longevity. Get it at avalonx.us with the coupon code IFPODCAST.
It's 12 people generally. We cook a mediocre meal. And when we sit down to eat, and it's all anonymous, you know people's first names and that's it. And then when we sit down to eat, we play a game to figure out what people do. And you find out that it's everybody from the, you know, Academy Award winning writer of Little Miss Sunshine and Toy Story 3 and The Hunger Games and all that, all the way to the, you know, 10-time Olympic medalists in swimming, or the guy who won a Grammy for barking on Who Let the Dogs Out. I've hosted about 4,000 people.
Incredible. And I just thought of somebody else you have to have, and he's in New York. And there's a reason I thought about it, because you referenced something tangential to him. But
cool.
Yes. I have just one last rabbit hole tangent question about this. I think about this a lot, actually, because like you just said, we're constantly meeting new people and having substantial dialogue with them. So engaging with them, meeting them. And now, honestly, the majority of my good friends I've met on this show, I get really overwhelmed by, is it true that we can only maintain 300 relationships in our head at one time?
That's a kind of misnomer. So what you're talking about is an experiment by a researcher named Dunbar, where he looked at, I think it was mammals and their brains, and looked at how big their social groups are as a species. So you look at wolves, you look at maybe otters or something. I don't even know what he looked at. And what he found was that this specific section of the brain seems to grow with the number of social ties. And Dunbar said, based on the human brain, that means that number is about 150. And this became known as Dunbar's number. That's completely theoretical. It's not based on actual evidence of the number of people you remember or whatever it is. In fact, when it comes to working memory, there's this paper called 4 ± 3, which is the kind of ideal numbers that you can kind of store in your head and how much you can have in working memory. But the point of this is when you're in a community, communities can only be so big before you start feeling disconnected, right? So if you're in a small town with a few thousand people, everybody kind of knows each other, right? Because everybody went to the same high school and all that kind of stuff. Oh, you're Jimmy's cousin or whatever, right? When you get to the size of New York, when somebody says, oh, I have a friend who lives in New York, do you know them? The answer is no, of course not. There's 8 million people in the area. Like, there's no sense of community or belonging. And so there probably is an upper max. My hunch is it's different for different people based on their social skills and so on. And I think that technology has allowed us to expand beyond the normal number because you can stay in touch with people through social platforms like LinkedIn and so on. So people that you've completely forgotten about, but you can pick up where you left off. So, you know, that camp friend experience where like you don't see somebody for years, but it's exactly, the relationship is exactly where you left it. We have a lot of that kind of stuff. People we used to work with at old companies or people we met at events and things along those lines. So I think it's like a nice idea, but it isn't something that's like a hard and fast rule.
That was really helpful for me because I will rant every now and then get a little bit acutely stressed out about wanting to maintain all these different relationships with people that I've met. And then like, but is that possible? And then literally I will have times where then I think of you and I'm like, but John is meeting people like 24/7. And he seems to do a pretty good job of, I mean, at least from our relationship, like, you know, creating an actual real relationship with people, but he's meeting so many people.
Can I make a recommendation for you? And you actually do this very well, is when I first started the dinners, the issue became, how do I meet as many people as possible? And then it quickly turned into, holy cow, I'm not going to be hanging out with all these people all the time. This just isn't realistic. And I also didn't want to hang out with everybody who came. But what I realized was that the more people I can connect to each other, the more I can keep people in my orbit. So think about it like this. If the only person you know in my social circle is me, then the chances that we'll bump into each other and stay aware of each other is very low. But if you are friends with 50 of my friends, you're going to show up in conversation, we'll bump into each other at other events, right? It keeps us in each other's orbit. And there's a very cynical reason for that. And the reason is that for most people, if I make a new friend for them, right, I introduce them to somebody, they're going to have to end up giving up a friendship somewhere else because they're just not great at maintaining friendships. So now it recenters their life a little bit closer to me. Now that's the cynical interpretation that some social scientists believe. But it also makes sense. Like most people only manage so many relationships. So if I can introduce you to a whole slew of people, then it keeps you around. And since I want you to positively impact my life, that benefits me. And hopefully knowing all these amazing people that I know will benefit you. It's healthy all around.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And that is naturally, I love connecting people to people and then outside of my sphere as well. But, and that was kind of the takeaway of you're invited, like the power of the invitation to other people.
The basis of you're invited was that when researchers were looking at the obesity epidemic, they found that, Melanie, if you had a friend who's obese, you have a 45% increased chance of obesity. Your friends who do not know them have a 20% chance increase, and their friends have a 5% chance increase. And this kind of effect is true for happiness, marriage and divorce rates, smoking habits, voting habits, all these factors that become contagious that have to do with the quality of our life. And so I said, I'm overweight, broke, and underemployed. How do I change these things? And rather than participating in another like personal development course, I said, okay, I'm going to figure out how to make friends who are top in their field in all these things. Now, Melanie, you achieved that through your podcast. I achieved it through cooking terrible food.
Amazing. I have two topics that relate to things we were just talking about that bring it back to your current book. One is, so you were mentioning how like the size of communities and, you know, if you're from New York and then you have a friend in New York, it's very unlikely that you actually know them. Like, it's such a big community. And yet, interestingly, I think I've thought about this a lot throughout my life. Like, so I was from Memphis, for example. And if I were ever somewhere else and then I would meet somebody and they were from Memphis, I'd be like, oh, I probably know them, which is like silly because I probably don't know them. But like your initial inclination is like, if you're outside of your community and then you meet somebody else from the community, you're like, oh, I must know them, even if it's a really big community that you're from. So does that relate to, because you have a whole section on company culture and this role of like membership and like symbol systems and things like that. So what is that role in like a team's intelligence, the actual feeling of the club that people are in?
So let's answer this question in two parts. The first part is, why do you have that experience when you're traveling? And the answer has to do with what's kind of called the common ground theory of relationships, which is that human beings tend to become friends or connect when they have a lot of things that are common. So if two people go to the same church, same gym, and same have kids in the same high school, they're much more likely to be friends because that commonality causes us to feel safe. Things that are familiar, that we're exposed to often, are safe. And people who share those things with us are likely what we would consider community members. When you are in a foreign place and you find something that's such unique common ground with a human being, like you're both in Japan, but you're both from Memphis, what's the chances that you'll meet each other? It feels very safe and familiar. And so you're more likely to be friends in Japan than you were in Memphis.
And you're more likely to assume that you had met them before.
Or have some kind of common, oh, have you ever been to that restaurant? Oh, we must have both been there. You know, oh, you would go to the parties at that place, or, oh, that's the gym you worked at. I was, you know, whatever it is, you will find examples of that are familiar to each other that make you feel safe. Now, whether you should or shouldn't feel safe with a person, I don't know. But that's just the natural mechanics of being human. Now, how it plays in a team is that when there's a sense of a common mission, common goal, that you're heading in the same direction, it very much enforces a culture that you're in it together. And human beings survived as a species and were rewarded as a species for collaboration, right? Like, bottom line, a mother who just gave birth cannot collect enough calories and protect her offspring by herself. Like, it's just not realistic. We're one of the few species that's the case, right? Like, a deer, when they give birth, they're like, fawn can just go run off right after. And so we need each other. And so our mechanics as a species are to reward collaboration. The issue is that for far too long, we have rewarded individualistic behavior. And as a byproduct, we've gotten our employees to compete with each other because we've rewarded the top 10%. And the only way to always be in the top 10%, like we said, was eventually to make sure that everybody else is in the bottom 90.
Are there companies that are doing this really well?
I think that's a great question. I'm sure there are, but they seem to be so few and far between. I'll give you an example. I was in a conversation with an executive at one of the big tech companies. And they said, John, yeah, that all sounds great, but you know, it's not realistic for us to give bonuses to everybody. Like, that'll be just so expensive. And I laughed because I said, why don't you just take the bonus money and share it with everyone? And their brain looked like it broke. Like, the idea that, oh my God, we could actually give this to everybody is, they just couldn't make sense. They're like, but then, I was like, the circuits just shorted out. I said, listen, here's the deal. People fundamentally compete for status. Do they use money as their status marker? Probably. They use that and a whole bunch of other stuff. And if that's the culture you want, go for it. But understand that it's not necessarily serving the company. It's creating individuals that are remarkable. You're enticing people to be selfish. Now, if instead what we said is, hey, the team that accomplishes X will be rewarded with blank as a team, we will take you all and your spouses on a vacation. That's probably the same amount that you're paying for bonuses, but it makes everybody feel great. Or maybe it's not a vacation, maybe it's a something else. I don't even know. If I keep rewarding individual behavior, it will eventually come at the cost of the team, because you can't keep telling people you'll get paid more if you score more and then expect them to pass the ball.
I think Taylor Swift does this pretty well. I don't know if you watched the docuseries.
Yeah, she has a really great reputation of recognizing people.
She like handwrote thank you notes to every team member of her tour and then gave out almost $150 million in bonuses to everybody.
I would not say no to a $150 million bonus.
Not individually, but like spread like between everybody. And then the status thing, that's a whole fascinating section of your book. You have the story about the yams.
The yam offs.
Yeah. And what's funny is like reading that, you're like, that's so silly that they have all this status based on the size of yams. But then you think about like, if you practically step away and like look at our life.
We should probably tell the listeners what we're talking about. There's this island, I believe it's called Panape, where the way that people earn status in the society is by the size of their yams, like the actual vegetable. And people compete year after year to grow the largest yams they can. And then they bring them to festivals. And the people who consistently bring the largest yams earn titles and status in society and potential chiefdoms and stuff like that. And these yams are just gigantic, because when you find a pissing contest, people will compete very hard to outdo each other. And these yams require like sometimes 4 people to carry them. They're just humongous. And so it just sounds absurd. But you were saying, Melanie.
I was saying it sounds absurd. And then though, if you look at what we do for status and really separate yourself from it, it's equally absurd. Like purses, like brands and stuff. Like, okay, so that this purse has like this logo on it. Now
I'm better than you. Now I deserve to get into the nightclub or the job or date the person who has better mating characteristics. Yeah. Some of the funniest status things was in the UAE, I think it was, people were spending millions of dollars to get a license plate with the lowest number. So if you wanted a single digit license plate, you were spending literally millions just as a FU contest.
Yeah, it's so interesting. But I do like the concept that we can't, or at least when I interviewed Dr. Loretta Bruning, she has a lot of books on stuff, but one is called The Status Game. One is called Status Games. And it's all about this. And she makes the case that we are naturally wired for to seek status. So we shouldn't see it as a negative thing. Like, it's not bad that you want status, but just don't like hurt other people while trying to get status.
Oh yeah, of course. Like, you know, when you're a teenager and you're a boy, you're trying to be stronger, better, faster than the other boys, or smarter, or whatever it is. And the girls do their thing, and society's probably changed a bit. But yeah, we all have, like, that makes perfect sense, because a species would need to be hard-coded to figure out who the ideal mate is so that there can be offspring. And whether it's an absurd dance that a bird does or a peacock flashing its feathers or something else, there needs to be a mechanism.
And speaking of animals, one of my favorite topics that we haven't touched on yet, this was mind-blowing to me. The history, well, there were a few different sections where it was the history of something, which was not at all what I thought, but one was the history of the alpha male concept. The experiments in wolves were not what I thought.
So this is so wild.
No pun intended.
Oh, no. Yeah, definitely no pun. I wasn't even thinking. You know, we're used to thinking about leadership in a bunch of kind of principles. And as I was researching this idea that, oh, it's the alpha male that dominates and controls, and that's what makes a great leader, really kept showing up. And as I looked into this, I ended up coming across this crazy story that in the 1970s, a book called The Wolf was released. Now, in it, the author, L. David Meek, shared kind of the latest research, which wasn't very in-depth at the time. They have much more knowledge now. And there was this one experiment where a bunch of wolves were put into a room together and they fought each other until one came out dominant and he controlled the pack. But it turns out that in nature, that's not how they operate. But in the book, that was the one data point he had, so he shared it. The book became a huge hit to the point that a New York Times review was written by one of the Supreme Court justices. That's crazy. And he ended up on like the most popular late night show at the time. And it sold thousands and thousands of copies. And business world used it as an excuse that like, as the leader, I'm the alpha wolf, I'm going to dominate and control. But it turns out that in nature, it doesn't work like that. It turns out that in fact, when you do see kind of dominant behavior, it's usually child rearing. Meaning that when a wolf reaches mating age, they break off from the pack, they find a mating pair, and then they have cubs. And when those can be very large, and as they're teaching them to function, they'll often pin them down so that they don't do something stupid or get themselves killed. And so it looks like really dominant behavior, but it's just raising your child. It's like if your kids started running into the street and you grabbed them and yelled at them. Like, that's not dominant behavior. It's just saying, hey, you're going to get hurt. You can't do that. I need to scare you a little. And so we thought that it was one thing and it was something completely different. It turns out that even in nature, wolves that are overly aggressive end up getting the pack into fights and weakening the pack. And, or the other wolves don't want to stick around and be dominated like that, so they leave and join other packs. The entire myth of the alpha leader is total BS. Nobody wants to be dominated constantly by their boss. And when you negotiate with somebody who's always trying to get something from you that's extreme, then nobody wants to do business with them unless they have to. Steve Jobs is famous for like trying to get the most intense deal possible. And after about a year, companies would come back and say, we're canceling this contract because we can't live up to these terms. And they'd have to renegotiate everything anyway. And so it doesn't actually work unless you can be a full bully at all times, like unless you have all the cards. And in fact, leaders that are more compassionate tend to do better and people want to stick around and work for them.
Speaking of that, because I was going to ask earlier when we were talking about super skills, what are examples of other super skills? Because I bet listeners are pretty curious what super skills they might have. Is there just like a list somewhere?
I think that that we have to understand that we're inventing an idea to help us understand something. It's not the truth, right? So Melanie, you are incredibly inquisitive, right? You are curious and you ask questions and you are willing to reevaluate stuff. You have what's called cognitive humility. It's where you're willing to reevaluate the ideas that you believe if new evidence comes in. But it's not that every new idea changes your mind immediately. Now, those are some of your super skills. And that's what makes you a great podcast interviewer, is that you're genuinely willing to look at things. Now, somebody else might be a great podcast interviewer because they out-research people. They read everything. There's a guy named Brandon Fong who does this. He just devours. He spends hours researching everyone. But that's his super skills at play. My super skills are kind of being able to communicate complex ideas and developing trust with people. And so when I express things, people tend to understand them and it makes sense and trust what I'm saying is true. The best way, I think, for your listeners to figure out some of their super skills is to ask people that they interact with. And not ask them for like, what am I good at, like creating PowerPoints, but what unique skills do I have that support those things? Right? You might be great at PowerPoint because you're an amazing storyteller. You might be great at PowerPoint because you feel really comfortable in front of groups, but that's not a super skill. Your super skill is actually your willingness to practice over and over and over, and you're relentless about practice. So you can boil those down and realize like, oh, it is those skills that cause people to want to engage with me. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't develop other skills, but you should understand that that's the basis of your strength.
And what about the fact, because all of these skills that you're describing are all, you know, positive aspects and traits, presumably, What about the fact when you have a section, there's a section in the book for listeners on toxic people in the work culture and the dark triad and narcissists, and you point out that narcissism actually does enhance, I think, like business interview success.
Another resource for you guys. If you struggle with food sensitivities like I do, you have got to get my app, Food Sense Guide. It's a comprehensive catalog of over 300 foods for 11 potentially problematic compounds. These include things you may be reacting to, like gluten, lectins, FODMAPs, histamine, oxalates, sulfites, thiols, whether or not something is a nightshade, and so much more. It even includes autoimmune paleo AIP status. You can learn about the compounds, create your own list to share and print, and finally take charge of your food sensitivities. It is a top Apple app, often in the top 10 for the Apple food and drinks charts. And friends, get it now because I'm going to be updating it to a subscription basis soon. So you definitely want to get grandfathered in for life at one super low price. With the subscriptions, by the way, I'm going to be implementing some pretty cool features, so I need to do subscriptions to help support that. So like I said, get it now before we change to subscriptions. You can get it at melanieavalon.com/foodsenseguide.
Yeah, so here's what's interesting. There are these four, let's call them psychological characteristics, that are more dangerous than probably anything else. They're called the dark tetrad. They are being narcissistic, you make it all about you, or the person makes it all about themselves. There's Machiavellianism. Everybody is just a tool for the person to achieve their personal goals. There's sadism. People actually enjoy making you suffer or making others suffer. And psychopathy, which is being a psychopath. It's a thin veneer of charm, hiding a lack of remorse and often impulsive behavior.
Mm-hmm. One of my exes.
Yeah. Congrats for getting away from that. Holy cow. So what ends up happening is we have to ask, okay, are these things bad or good or whatever? And the answer is that in the corporate world, people who are willing to manipulate will often rise to the top. And that's because we keep rewarding individual success.
Okay. So it's like a system problem.
Yeah. The other issue is that often people are incredibly talented and narcissistic. So look at a Steve Jobs. He might have had a toxic characteristic that is dangerous, but he's so damn talented that it's worth for the company to put up with it, right? Apple was fundamentally better off with Steve Jobs than without him. But it does mean that you need a C-suite that knows how to handle it. Because people would say he has a bubble around him, like that he would warp reality, a reality warping bubble or something. And that's because these personalities can be so strong and so talented or skilled that they are really useful to the company. The other thing is that trying to call somebody out for being a narcissist doesn't work. Their egos are too fragile and they'll go on the attack. And that's basically true for any dark personality. You never want to call them out. Are there things you can do that'll benefit your situation? Yeah. There's a fantastic person. I don't know if you've ever had her on, Dr. Ramani.
No.
Oh my God. You should definitely have her on. She's incredible. And she's basically one of the big experts on the topic. And she's just fantastic. She's the person I interviewed to understand this for my book. And there are ways to protect yourself from these toxic personalities, but you're probably not going to win going toe-to-toe with them because they have a lot more experience manipulating people than you do stopping a manipulator.
Or you pointed out even going to HR necessarily because the goal of HR is to protect the company.
Yeah. There are very few HRs that are really going to look out for, do they exist? Yeah. But that are really trying to look out for the employees. The key is to make sure that the company is not liable for something. So if you say, oh, somebody's a narcissist and they're dangerous, then they start getting really curious. Oh my God, do we have a lawsuit? Is there sexual harassment? That's where the liabilities are. And if it's between making you happy and protecting the company, their responsibility is to the company.
Well, that's upsetting.
I mean, yeah, you know, every system is designed to keep itself alive.
Yeah. And then on the flip side, you can have the complete opposite sort of action, which you talked about, like in your own experience at your company, you instigated an anti-jerk policy for your behavior?
Yes. So I think we all have like these behaviors that come out on in rare occasions, or maybe more depending. And my thing became that anytime something would go wrong, I would notice that I had this habit of making people feel just terrible. And it wouldn't solve the problem. It was about me getting to feel better about my terrible emotional state. And so my habit was that I would actually ask people questions, but I wasn't really asking them questions. I was just trying to make them feel stupid. And so it would look like I was trying to solve the problem, but really I was just being a jerk. And so we had to put rules in place to prevent this from happening. And the problem is that when you're already in a crappy emotional state, you don't have the wherewithal to stop yourself. You're too far down the path. So what we needed to do is create rules to prevent it from happening in the first place. So when something bad happened, we would divorce me from the situation so that I wouldn't be kind of, I'd never yell, but I'd never be upset at the employee who caused it. That way, enough time would pass that when we actually did try to figure out what the problem was, I was calm and collected and friendly. Now, it doesn't mean that we always kept everybody. We've, you know, replaced people over the years. But it did mean that we were really respectful in the process and actually came to figuring out what the solutions were rather than me being mean, which didn't really help anything.
It also speaks to just the power of systems and everything, which is appropriate because, you know, like we've been talking about all throughout this, it's not about, unless it's baseball, it's not about the individual people as much as the team and the systems that are running everything.
Yes. So it's, I think what we tend to do is we overvalue the individual and undervalue the team. In fact, and we were talking about that stat in basketball that it's player salary that predicts stuff. So we've incentivized people to be selfish. There's a stat that predicts if somebody's an effective coach, and it is not how much they win, because you might just not have the base level of talent that you need to succeed. Talent is still incredibly important. You know, you're not going to win a basketball championship with a bunch of fifth graders. But the factor that matters when it comes to coaching is the increase in the rate of passing under that coach. Meaning, if you're my coach and I've gone from passing 60% of the time to passing 90% of the time, now the ball will land with a player that has the best chance of actually scoring rather than with me, because I want to earn those extra points. And so the team is more likely to win when people are playing towards a common goal.
And do these principles apply regardless of company size? So if you have, you know, just a few people on your team versus like hundreds of people?
I think you'll probably feel it the most when there's a few people on the team, because you'll be acutely aware. So if you had a team of five people, and one of those people is constantly saying, "Hey, Melanie, I know that you're the host of the show, but I think I should really be on," and so on and so forth, then they're wasting a lot of time trying to get attention for themselves rather than creating the best product possible. When you're at the level of a company, it turns out that at the average company, there's complete misalignment. 60% of employees have no idea what the company's mission is. How do you know you're heading in the right direction if you do not know what the company's trying to accomplish? Of the remaining 40%, 60% of them don't care. So imagine we're on a hike. 60% of people don't know where we're going. 24% of them do not care. They're just like off in a field picking daisies. They might know where we want to end up, but they're not motivated to get there. That leaves 16% of people gathering everybody and trying to make sure that they're headed in the right direction. You're herding cats. And want to make a team or an organization stupider?
Distract them.
Yeah, like constantly have them go in different directions. There's a big tech company that at one point I think had five different teams producing video chat software. Like, what an incredible, colossal waste of time and money. And when you realize it and start shutting down those teams, the level of morale after people have put their heart and years of work into something just to have it shut down. Like, talk about disincentivizing an employee. That's incredible. You need to know where you're going, and you need to make sure everybody else does.
I've actually thought about that a bit because I reflect and remember when I was like working in waiting tables and like serving jobs, and there would be all these meetings with like the company mission statement and ideals. And I look back and remember how much I just didn't care. And I think about it when I think about my work now as an entrepreneur, and I'm like, oh, I should have like a mission statement and ideals, and like it actually means a lot. But then I think about myself in the past where it didn't matter to me. And it's like, it's almost like it can be there, but how do you make people actually care? Like that 60% or whatever percent of people, you know, who don't, you know, care where they're going. I don't know if there was a question in there, but basically how do you, and I know we're like coming up on time, but you can't make people care. So is that one of a good criteria for hiring people, like their personal passion?
I think there are two aspects. The first is people often talk about cultural fit as critical. I would encourage cultural adaptability, which is that if you have a company, the focus of your company now and the focus of your company in 10 years might be completely different. You want people who can adapt to the different cultures. The second thing is when we talk about creating alignment, right? The first thing is that you need the person to know what the company's mission is. Bottom line. You need to know what your team's role is within that company so that it can feed into the bigger mission. You understand your purpose and what you contribute to the organization as a whole. You need to know what your role is within the team. And the step that nobody seems to take is aligning people's personal goals with their work goals. Let's take an example from your life. What's a personal goal you have right now?
Well, my personal goals, I feel, are my work goals. That's not a career goal.
No, just pick something, whatever it is.
Launch my coffee line in February.
Great. Now, let's say you're like, John, I'm so tired of recording these podcasts, blah, 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 blah. But you're super hyped on your coffee, right? So I'd say, Melanie, I'm so excited for you. I love this goal for you. Having a coffee line is just awesome. Now, as we think about that, I want to make sure that the show doesn't get less of your attention and suffer in the process. I want us to think about how do we make sure that the show becomes the launch pad for it? Get the guests on that might be most excited to learn about your product and potentially promote it. And then as I'm talking to this about you, I will tie the coffee back into everything that you do so that you feel that fulfilling on the show and doing that at the highest level and your fitness and so on, whatever it is, fulfills on launching that coffee line. For somebody else, it might be they want to buy a home, but don't think that they're going to make enough working at the company to put down that down payment. I would talk to them about how if we hit our goals, the bonus will be so big that they'll be able to get their dream home. And so can I count on you for the next year to stay focused so that we can hit that goal and you can be able to make that money to put the down payment down? I've aligned everything so that you're not off launching a Twitch channel to make money to buy a house or Uber Eats or, you know, whatever it is that people do for side hustle. OnlyFans.
Yes. Okay. It's like my serving manager who knew my love of wine and would have like wine contest rewards for certain things accomplished in the job.
Yeah. Perfect. But for that, you have to have conversations with your people, or you have to have the person on your team that knows this stuff and you empower them to do it, because not every leader's super skills is getting to know their people. Right. And it's an unfair expectation for the leader to be great at all this stuff. So empower somebody else on the team that's the heart.
Awesome. Well, I have a proposal. My proposal is, because we didn't talk about this, so listeners will have to just read the book to learn about the shocking history of the MBA. But I would propose instead of the MBA, people just read your book, Team Intelligence.
I would be ecstatic if everybody picked up a copy or 20. Depending on when this episode is released, it could make a great stocking stuffer for next year's holiday season.
That's a little thing for listeners, not related to this topic, but do your Christmas shopping throughout the year. So like, let gifts come to you, and then come Christmas time, you already have gifts for everybody because you've been casually letting them come to you throughout the year. So people, buy lots of copies of this book, and then come Christmas, or whatever holiday you celebrate. There you go.
Melanie, you're the best.
Thank you, John. This has been absolutely amazing. So how can people best follow your work, get your book? Are you writing another book?
I am probably going to work on a children's book next.
A children's book?
It happens when you have three kids. My name is John Levy, J-O-N.
Well, you don't have three kids. You have one kid, right?
Oh, and by the time this comes out, I'll have my third kid.
What? Wait, did I miss a second shot? Wait.
Yes, you did.
Whoa.
Anyway, so you can find me at John Levy, JONLEVY.com. And on all the socials, I'm John Levy TLB, JONLEV as in Victor, Y as in yellow, T like Thomas, L like lion, B like boy. On all the socials, I'm super responsive, so feel free to reach out. I'm most active on LinkedIn and probably TikTok, and I welcome hearing from you all. And Melanie, thank you so much for having me on. It's always a joy to hang out with you.
No, thank you. And very last rapid fire. I don't know if you remember this question from last time. It's always the last question, though. What is something that you're grateful for?
Oh, man. I, 10 years ago, plus at this point, walked up to a woman at an airport and convinced her to switch her seat on her flight to sit next to me. And that woman and I are married with three incredible kids, and I could not be more thankful that she said yes to everything. I'm super appreciative of her.
That's amazing. Oh my goodness. Well, thank you so much. You are the best. I can't wait for your kids' book and can't wait to talk to you soon. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Melanie. I'll catch you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information and resources, you can check out my book, What, When, Wine, as well as my supplement line, Avalon X. Please visit melanieavalon.com to learn more about today's guest. And always feel free to contact me at contact@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.